I swore I could not meditate. I remember 36 years ago telling my sponsor, I can't meditate. I don't know how to meditate. The head is too busy. I can't do what y'all are asking me to do. He said, what do you do when you sit in a meeting? I said, well, I sit there and I listen to other people talk and other people read and other people speak. And I remain quiet. He said, how long does that last? Welcome to meditation. If you're new, and it's the highest rank you get is sober, it's not speaker. So it's don't set your expectation bar that high. I love being up here. I'm from elevation zero on the beach in Destin, Florida. My home group is Busters for Sobriety. Did I say I was chipping? I'm an alcoholic. I have a sponsor by the name of Tim that lives in Louisville, Kentucky, and I sponsor guys. And I got a home group called Busters for Sobriety. And we meet every... See, people know Busters. Like, we're like worldwide. We were in Africa, and they go, shoot, I've been Busters. We meet every single day of the week at 8 o'clock in the morning. And people go, why in the world do you have to meet every single day of the week? Say, because we need to. The Destin police appreciate it. The families appreciate it. We're a destination meeting. If you ever go to Disney World and you go to... and you go to Friends of Bill W. meeting, that you have no idea what you're in for. So at the noon meeting, it's always a speaker meeting, and they always pick the speaker right after they read chapter 5 in the traditions. And so then they'll go, and I'd like to introduce you to your speaker, eeny, meeny, my, you. And it could be a French person, a German person, a Swedish, we don't know. But they just get up and they give a talk. And they tell their story, and it's exactly the way Bill Wilson described how we do it. If you're new, people would say, well, what do you do when you tell your story? You're supposed to be entertaining. This is not the military. I am a retired Air Force guy. I gave them 20 years, 10 months, and 4 days. So thank you very much for our veterans. I retired at the ripe age of 39 years old and just turned over into 40 years old. And that was 30 years ago. And it's I've been around a long time. But the... This is kind of an amazing deal because this is more like a retreat than it is a conference. We get to go to some of these retreats that there could be 1,000, 2,000 people there, the state conventions, and it's not that intimate because it's busy, it's crazy, it's like Gatling gun, AA, and Al-Anon. There's meetings here, tennis, you're fishing, you're doing, but you come to a retreat, a situation like this, and it's kind of like a relaxing, you just get to download and defrag. And I go to two men's retreats a year. And that is, one of them is 250 hairy-legged spiritual guys and talking about AA steps, sponsorship, and God, no perfume. And that's in Central Florida at the Central Florida Men's Workshop every year. And then I go to the one that my sponsor started decades ago, and that's the Kentucky Man-to-Man Conference. And much like alcoholics, we land by airplane in Louisville, Kentucky, but they cross the border into Indiana to the monastery, but they refuse to call it the Indiana Men's Retreat. Alcoholics are just that way. I'm glad to be here with my darling bride who's going to speak tomorrow, one of my good buddies, Cushing. And Cushing and I have spoken together before. We had a little battle royal going on. Because his dad was a Navy officer, my dad was a Navy officer. He was born in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I graduated high school in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And then we kept going on and on. He said, well, my dad was a commander. He said, well, my dad was a captain. I said, well, I got more sober than you. it's just that alcoholic. You can't top an alcoholic. So it's good to be with him. Next weekend, we're going to be at the Chipley Country Roundup. And that was started in 1996, and it's at the Agricultural Center in Chipley, Florida. It's not really that big, so don't think you're missing anything. But it's a beautiful little agricultural town, and so they have it at the Agricultural Center. When they first started having it, it's where they would tie the hogs up when they would have all the auctions go on. So they still had the hog rings up at the front of the stage, and then they would start the meeting by ringing the cowbells, and then they would have everything, and it's still that way. They have the red checkerboard tablecloths, and it's all an open buffet all weekend long, and it's just fun. And I didn't think I was going to have any fun when I got here. I was raised the son of a naval officer that used to be enlisted. Mm-hmm. I was the actual, for 7 years of my life, I was the not only the firstborn male, I was the baby. So I was the birthright child of my family, and I was the baby, so I got all the attention. And then on my seventh birthday, my brother was born. Yeah. So immediately, I lost all my status. I went from being the only male, baby of the family, to middle child, babysitter. My whole life just changed. I thought maybe I became an alcoholic because of the way I was raised. Strict. We remember that. Angie's dad was an Army officer. Mine was a Navy commander. So we were raised in a strict military discipline. And we learned that we had to pack up and move all the time. This is water, in case you're wondering. Hear the ice? I obey the rules. I've been to jail. But they didn't look like this when I was in the Key West drunk tank. No. So I didn't have any reason, really, to be an alcoholic. We ran up and down the tree. We couldn't shake any nuts loose. There were no alcoholics in the family tree. Maybe my grandfather drank a little bit too much. I was trying to pin it on somebody. I was 32 years old. I had a successful military career. I had an arm full of stripes, a chest full of medals. How in the world could I be an alcoholic? I look back. I was sitting there in the Adelanto Motel, room 222. And this is George Air Force Base, Victorville, California, where the only claim to fame they had was they had Roy Rogers' horse Trigger stuffed at the Trigger Museum, right? So I was up there with a bunch of fighter jets. I was 6 months and 3 weeks sober in AA, and I didn't want to be sober. But I was doing the deal. I was going to meetings. I heard what you said. Go to meetings, don't drink, and read the big book. So I went to meetings. I didn't drink, and I read the big book. But that's all I did, because I didn't ask anybody, you're supposed to do anything else. So I just went to meetings. At 6 months and 3 weeks sober, I drank. I just couldn't. It wasn't a slip. It's like, how can you go back to somewhere you've never been? I was never in AA. I was at AA. And so I was running the meetings, right? And I just didn't want to be sober. And I would stay nice and serene and sit in the back of the room and not. I wasn't going to attract any attention to myself for an hour. Then I'd go home and I'd terrorize that little family. And I'd go home to work. I'd go back to work and I'd terrorize 600 guys. And then I'd come back to AA the next night, and I'd be spiritual and wonderful for an hour. That's what it's like if you're here and you're not working the steps. I was stark raving sober and couldn't stand being sober. I didn't want to tell anybody that. I didn't want the Monday night visitation. I didn't want the people knocking on the door, banging this big book saying, heal! And I knew that I had the rest of my life ahead of me. I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. So what do you do when you're in that kind of predicament like that? I said, well, I have to line it up. If you're going to have a slip, you have to be good and you have to line it up, right? So maybe I could come up with this game plan on what I was supposed to do as far as having a slip. I used to sit at the house and I go, well, if I come home and the toothpaste tube cap is off, that's it. Cross the line. Or the tennis shoes are not grounded to the inspection side underneath the bed. I swore I was never going to be like my parents. I was never going to raise anybody with a star chart and a little, here's your allowance. And by the way, you got to work. You got to have a paper route. You got to cut grass. See, I was the kid with the paper route, and I was pedaling that bicycle, and I had those great big newspapers in the basket. But I'm an alcoholic. I'm not normal. So I have a string at the back of the bicycle, and I'm towing a lawnmower with me, and I got a can of gas on the handlebars. Because I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to deliver your paper and cut your grass at the same time. I'm going to multitask. So when did I become an alcoholic? I need to know when I became one. So I would sit around these meetings. I'd go, if I'm an alcoholic, when did I become one? What was I drinking? Who was I drinking with? Who was I married with? Who was I sleeping with? Where was I working? What was I doing? I wanted to know there was some definite lightning bolt that changed me from being a normal drinker to an alcoholic, and if you could prove that to me, maybe I would accept it. And I just couldn't understand it. So what I did was I chose to drink. I had all my crew chiefs with me. We went out to the bars. I started off, this is my story. I don't care what your story is. It's my story. The book tells me exactly what I'm supposed to do when it talks about this story. Oh, here's the big book, right? What are we supposed to do? Bill Wilson put it in writing, thank God. Each individual in his personal story describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And that doesn't mean a whole lot of puking when you start reading that. I'm like, oh. But we're supposed to tell our story, and we're supposed to tell it in a general way. So I would just run around, and I'm going, what am I doing? So I went out there, and I said, well, I will drink some of that non-alcoholic beer. So I started drinking non-alcoholic beer. Got to the third bar. I said, you got any of that non-alcoholic beer? I said, no. What do you got? I said, we got L.A. beer. I said, give me one. And the crew chief said, no, boss, you're like, you could do the A&A thing. You're not supposed to drink. Non-alcoholic beer is cool, right? But what is that L.A. stuff? I said, don't worry about it. Same stuff at non-alcoholic beer. I knew exactly what it was. It was low alcohol beer. One half of the amount of alcohol in a normal beer is 2.5. I can calculate quick when it comes to drinking. So I said, for 3 days I did that. And here's what happened. So you don't have to do that if it's ever come to your mind. I will explain exactly what happened to me. I drank for 3 days, and I tried to control and enjoy my drinking like the normal people. So when they drank, I drank. When they lit a cigarette, I lit a cigarette. When they went to the bathroom, I went to the bathroom. When they went to bed, I didn't. Something was different in that entire scenario. From the obsession of the mind to the absolute craving, the compulsion to drink, because once it went past my lips, it changed. The alcohol changed. It went from looking at it to having it inside, and something happened. And for 3 days, I tried to do it exactly the way they did it, and I could not function exactly the way that they were functioning. So I was on the telephone, and I called the wife at the time, and I said, I have been drinking. Now, she had been going to Al-Anon, and I was an immense 6 months and 3 weeks sober. And I said, I've been drinking. And then I waited for the big kaboom to happen. She said, would you do me a favor? I'm like, yes. She said, would you go back to AA? And I said, don't you want to talk about my drinking? And she said, no. I just want to know if you'll go back to AA. Little beknownst to me, I had started changing, and I didn't even know it. But they noticed it. And all she wanted me to do was not try to promise I wasn't going to drink. She just wanted to know if I would go back to AA, because she saw something happen in 6 months and 3 weeks that I didn't see happen. And she just wanted me back there. So I stopped on the 22nd of November, 1987. Didn't want to. Just made a decision. I still had a refrigerator full of beer in room 222. What a dilemma. You think that's bad? I'm going to make you hurt now. I got on the airplane to come home, and the airplane ground aborted. You know what happens when you ground abort? When they hold you at the taxiway, the drink cart comes down the aisle. In those days, in the 80s, it was free drink time. They're going to appease the passenger, so they'll just roll that cart down. And I'm like, Diet Coke. And it was, I came back, and I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. First honest thing I said in 6 months and 3 weeks of AA, drinking for 3 days, I says, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. You see, now I'm 33 years old. And I have this, I keep going, I got stripes and I got medals and I got stuff. I have everything to prove that I'm not an alcoholic. And they go, well, what is the problem that you're having with this alcoholism stuff? And I was just fighting it. I just had that push me, pull you thing. I had this little chip on my shoulder, my sponsor called Little Chip. And I was like a little Tasmanian devil. I was rebellious, and I was just fighting. So I said, I need to know. I need to know when I became an alcoholic. I got all these. In the military, we got questions. You go to a tech order manual, right? And I have all these questions, and I'm asking the old timer. I'm going to give Burl a 58-year medallion this September. He was my sponsor for the first 28 years. And he said, what kind of questions? I said, I need to know. When did I become an alcoholic? He said, let's go. We went to California. He took me to Palm Springs, to the Palm Springs powwow. I got to meet Mac Brewster from the 502 Club, West Covina. Got sober in 1966. And here's what he said. You need to know when you became an alcoholic. I said, yeah, man, if I had that marked in the calendar. He said, if you're like me, just like the old timers will lock you in, you probably became an alcoholic when you quit bragging about how much booze you drank and started lying about how much you really did. And I'm like, ooh. And then I started to be able to hear. See, I kept looking for Bill Wilson in the big book and the hot flash and the cool, clean wind as it's blowing across the top of the icy mountain and that great big spiritual poltergeist And I just, little guy, lay in bed at night, not being able to sleep, and I got a head full of questions. So here's what happened. I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. He said, well, he said, you know, he said, what did you do? He said, you lasted for 6 months, and then you, I said, well, it's big book approved. You got to watch when you point to the big book and to an old timer and tell him what's in it. I said, it's big book approved. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, it says if you're not sure, you can belly up to the nearest bar stool and try some controlled drinking. Try it more than once. I tried it for 3 days. He said, and what was the result? I said, didn't work very good on the third day. And I came back. He said, so? He said, you forgot to turn 2 pages in a big book. And I said, what do you mean? I know what the part about we're supposed to be able to go and do the drink. He said, well, he said, 2 pages later, I started talking about, well, let me tell it to you in case you want to know. It's page 34. If anyone questions he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. And I'm like, what? It's in there. It's been in there the whole time. And he said, so? He said, let's do the math. Now, Burl didn't even have a high school education, but he made all of his money laying floors in Long Beach, California when he got out of the Air Force. Now, he didn't have a high school education, but he started doing math on me, the guy with the stripes and the medals and the little degree, AA degree, right? He said, let's do the math. It asked you to stay sober for 1 year, and you stayed sober for how long? I said, 6 months. He said, so don't you kind of call that? I said, oh, half measures. He said, and half measures avail you what? I said, half measures avail you nothing. He said, good, that's step one. I said, what? He said, that's step one. Then I started being able to listen. The book talks about it. I started being able to hear as only the dying can hear. Because now I was starting to get answers to my questions. And Rose got up to the podium, and Rose got up there and said, I drank just alcohol gave me a license to act in an unsociable manner and excuse it off by saying, I am so sorry. I would not have done that if I hadn't been drinking. Man, did I tell that to that wife, those wives, those kids. My kids were 11, 10, and 9 years old when I sobered up. And I can remember them coming to the nut ward and watching Daddy locked up, detoxed in a nut ward. And they kept telling those kids and that wife they couldn't come in because it was under guard, lock and guard. They couldn't come in past the archway. And they're going, he's not going to drink anymore. Your life's going to become wonderful. I'm like, no, it's not. No, it's not. Nothing up here. What am I going to do about the guilt that I feel? What am I going to do about the things that I said to those kids when I was drunk? What am I going to do about all the fist holes I punched in the wall to get their attention? What about all the screaming and the yelling? You see, alcoholism has a noise to it. It's loud. And it's a lot of screaming and yelling and plates crashing, dishes flying everywhere, silverware punging up to the ceiling. Well, recovery has a noise too. And if you listen right now, that's what it sounds like. A peace of mind, serenity, and quiet. And that's what those kids were looking for. And I couldn't give it to them. So I started hanging around with the old timer. I said, okay, I got all these questions. I got to answer these questions before I can actually get locked in on these steps. He said, so we're going to have a problem with the steps. I said, no, I just have questions I got to get answered. He said, okay, what's your questions? I said, okay, let's start off first. What am I going to do about the wife? And he said, Chip, we have this big book. And in the big book, there's a chapter. It's called To the Wives. I hope that you read that chapter, and then if you got questions, you come ask me. I said, oh, yeah? What am I going to do about them kids? He said, Chip, we have this big book. And in the big book, there's a chapter called The Family Afterwards. Tells you all about that. You read it, and if you got questions, you come ask me. I said, okay, what am I going to do about the job? Oh, Chip. We got a big book, and in a big book, if you're new, listen, it's all here. There's a chapter called To the Employers, and it will tell you everything about that. I said, well, how's all this going to work? He said, whoa, how often do we read it? We got a chapter called Chapter 5 called How It Works. What is going to happen to me? He said, Chip, we got a big book. There's a chapter called A Vision for You. It will tell you all that stuff. I said, well, how am I supposed to go about all that stuff? He said, it's because we have to work with others. And in this big book, there's a chapter called Working with Others. What am I going to do about God? He said, Chip, man, we got a big book. He's old. And he went to this. I don't know how many times he's gone to that ordeal with guys that he sponsored, but I needed answers. And he gave me every one of the answers. And the reason I tell you that And the reason I always said that is my sponsor never once told me what to do about that wife. He never told me what to do about the kids. He never told me what to do about the job, never told me what to do about God. He never told me what to do about anything. He showed me where the answers were. Because what he wanted me to do was he wanted me to read this big book myself. And then if I got questions, then I go ask them. My sponsor was not going to sit down and read. You know, I thought I had designed the Evelyn Wood speed reading course on the big book. I couldn't sleep at night, so I said, I can't sleep. I have insomnia. So what do? I cannot sleep at all. He said, oh, I got something for you. He said, you got a little Walkman? This is the 80s, so you have to bear with me. You got a Walkman? I said, I got a Walkman. He said, well, he said, get those little foamy headphones at nighttime so you don't disturb your wife. He said, then I want you to take this package I'm going to give you, which was cassette tapes. And in those days, they were these little plastic square things. They had two little wheels in them. You carried a pencil in your pocket where you wore that tape out, that speaker tape, you wind it back up again. And man, I fell in love with speaker tapes. And thank God for the people that do our recordings, because people say now, oh, I can download all that stuff online. Who do you think recorded it so it ended up online? These are the people that record our history of all the people that we always wanted to go hear, and I was burning these tapes up. If I wanted to get out of my mind, I would plug in a tape. I would go half an hour drive on the way to work to Eglin Air Force Base. I'd hear half that tape on the way back. I would come all the way back. I'd hear the other end of the story, and I'd just be sitting there bawling and crying, and then I'd man up, walk inside the house, and terrorize them. So what he had me do, because I wasn't sleeping, so I was a little intense. I was like edgy all the time. So he said, I got this thing called the Big Book on Tapes. If you ever heard the Big Book on Tapes, it wasn't James Earl Jones that narrated, believe me. I don't know who it was. They might have gone to a detox center and said, here, read this. I'm going to record you. It goes like this. Rarely have we seen a person fail. And I had my head on that pillow and those little foamy headphones on. You could hear right through the foam, right? And my wife was laying there on the bed learning the Big Book. And I was asleep. I love to see all these medicines they advertise on TV. Well, if you have a problem with it, I'm like, get them the tapes, get them the tapes. And that's how I learned the Big Book, a lot of it, because I was sitting there laying there in subliminal sleep in twilight listening to the Big Book. And then at 45 minutes, that little door, the cassette door, would open up and go click. And she did not want me waking up, so she'd lean over by the pillow, change the tape to the other side, click it ever so quietly, hit play and go, whoo, he didn't wake up. It was fun being new. Not for them, but it was fun being new. And that's how I learned the Big Book. I had to read the Big Book. And then I thought, I am going to terrorize the guys that I sponsor, because now I'm staying sober longer and longer, and I'm starting to sponsor guys. I had this guy one time, he came up and said, would you be my sponsor? And I'm like, oh, number one, this is going to be my first. Oh, I'm going to get this guy. I said, let me call my sponsor and ask him to see what he says. Why don't you give me a call tomorrow night at 6 o'clock? Meeting's at 7. He said, okay. So he called me up and I said, meet me at McDonald's. I'll be in the booth. And he said, okay. During the day, I'd run down to central office and I bought every piece of AA literature I could afford off the shelves, right? And I ran to McDonald's about 6 o'clock and I built the AA altar of Chip. So I had all the literature laid out and displayed. And he walked into McDonald's and he looked. It was kind of obvious. Oh! So we went and sat in that booth and I said, that's right. We're going to read every bit of this stuff. We're going to do every bit of this stuff. And he just looked at me. And I can tell you all these years later, I've never seen that guy drink. Never seen him sober either. Never seen him at all. He ran. I had given him an AA enema, and he's like, I promise, running out the door. I sponsored this guy by the name of Tim. See, I'm growing in the program, and they're pushing me to start helping other people. And I'm sponsoring people when I think I'm too busy. And I had this guy by the name of Tim, redheaded Tim, and his wife kicked him out, moved his best friend into the house, and he was on my couch. Right? Then he ended up getting a place of his own, but I am responsible for his life, right? I am his sponsor. So we had this Gulf Coast Roundup come up, and I said, as we're supposed to do as a sponsor, First time, I'm going to buy your registration. Next time, you're going to buy another guy's. We're going to pass it on, pay it forward. I will buy your registration. You better be there. I mean, 20 bucks was 20 bucks, right? So there he was. He had his seat right there. I put his little name tag right there, Tim S., right? Friday night, he wasn't there. And I'm sitting in the front. I'm a front row AA. I'm sitting in the front. No Tim. And there's 350 people in there. No Tim. I am steaming in the front row. Speaker speaking, you can see the vapors coming up. I'm thinking, I know where that guy's at. He's chasing women is what he's doing. He's not in the seat. But Saturday, he wasn't there. He ain't answering his phone. Oh, I'm going to get him on Sunday. He better show up Sunday. Sunday didn't show up. But Monday night is home group. I am going to whip him. I'm going to get him on Monday night, and I'm going to read the entire riot act. I'm going to make him memorize the big book, and there'll be a test, right? He didn't show up Monday night. I am now angry. I've gone from being upset to going through a resentment, and now I'm pure anger. And I didn't tell the old-timer this. I got in that vehicle after that meeting, and I hauled butt to his house. And there's a two-lane gravel road all the way down to his. So I went down this two-lane gravel road, and I looked in the window, and there was that 25-inch color console. You could see it just glowing and flickering. And I'm like, oh, and I turned my headlights off, and the TV went off. Oh, you're going to hide from me? From me? You know how many stripes? You know how many medals? You're going to hide from me. So I'm like, hello? Answer the door. He would not answer. I know you're in there. Started getting awful loud. Wasn't funny at the time, believe me. I was ready to kill. I was going to chew tires, right? After about a half an hour, I am bawling and I'm crying at the front door. And I said, at least have the decency to open the door, please. And he wouldn't do it. And I went to the car, backed it all the way up, went back, got to see the sponsor the next day. Every day I was checking in with him at his store because I was supposed to. The kids appreciated that. On the way home from work, go to your sponsor, please. So I went there and I told him the whole deal. And he said, so he didn't show. And you were upset and you were angry. And I said, yeah. He said, well, Chip, evidently you took credit for his sobriety and now you're taking credit for his drinking. He said, you help everybody that you can. But we are alcoholics. We are not wired according to specification. We're not supposed to stay sober unless we have a spiritual awakening. You know, Dr. Bob's son, Smitty, used to say, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And I didn't know how to sponsor people after that. So what does God do? He sends me Big Al. Big Al got sober 8 months after I did. And he comes up and knocks on my door early one morning. Had this guy that was sponsoring him. He asked me to come out. I sit on the porch, and I know exactly what's going on in his life. And I said, what's up, Al? He said, I just want to ask if you would consider sponsoring me. I said, Al, we got sober together. I only got 8 months more than you do. He said, I need your help. I said, well, let me talk to the old-timer. So I ran and I talked to the old-timer. I said, what do I do? He said, Chip, he's not asking you to heal him. He's just asking you to help him. And I said, what have I got to offer? He said, Chip, he's watching you ahead of him 8 months. And everything that you're going through, he knows he's going to go through in 8 months. So you are teaching him right from wrong. You know, a guy in my home group says, you know, sometimes we are an example, and sometimes we are an example. So he's watching everything that I'm doing, and he wants you to pull him across the skids. So I went up and I told him, I said, okay. You know, I sponsor guys today, but this guy with 36 years calls me every single day. The other guys don't, but he still calls me every single day. And let me tell you how that came about. When we had about, let's see, I had been through another divorce. I had retired from the military, started a construction career. If you knew and you haven't done this, you got to get quick. I got to give 70 years in 45 minutes. So, where was I at? Al had packed up and left and moved down to Sarasota. We'd been sponsoring each other for a long time. We help each other out. If we can't figure, here's what we would do. If Al had a problem and I had a problem, because we were only 8 months apart, we had terrible, terrible relationship problems and issues with the wives and the kids, right? Plural. So I would go, well, what do you think we ought to do? He says, I don't know. Why don't we come up with a plan? We got tired of asking the old timer, what should we do? So we figured, we're men. Let's figure it out ourselves. So here's what we're going to do. Here's our great scheme. We're going to behave for 1 week. We're going to be the nicest, most cordial husband, father, boss as we can be for 1 week. And at the end of the week, we're going to get together and check out our score and see how things went. Well, I'm here to tell you it was the most miserable week of our lives. Because if we were going to throw a fit or we were going to scream and yell, we made a deal that we would call the other guy up and you got to validate it. Like, I'm about to kick that. He said, go ahead. Nope, can't do it. Got to be spiritual. So it was the worst week that we had. Then we went and asked the wives and the kids. That was the best week we ever had. And what we were doing was we were healing each other. We were becoming accountable to another man, helping each other out. I think I had about 20 years sober, and Al had about 8 months shy of 20 years. I always remind him of his 8 months lagging. And I knew that things were going awry in his life. When you get that close to another person, when you sponsor them, it becomes an intimate relationship, closer than most brothers and sisters. And I knew things were going south with his marriage. He'd moved down to Sarasota, worked construction down there, and he called me up. And I can date it because I was on top of a roof inspecting a roof, and I had a Motorola flip phone. But I'm a big contractor, so I got the big extended battery. You know, it's like way. And I got that thing on top of the roof, and I'm like, hello? Angie talks about it. When you're spiritually fit, and all the stars are aligned in your life, you can hear things you're not supposed to hear. You get this sixth sense that people talk about, the fourth dimension. You can pick out things in another person that they're not really telling you. You can hear the stuff between the lines. And I'm on top of that roof, and he doesn't sound good at all. Al's like me. He has an arsenal of weapons and a whole lot more of ammunition. He's a retired weapons loader on the fighter jets. So I said, Al, what's going on? He said, I just needed to call you, Sponce. I said, what's going on, Al? I can hear something in your voice. Al had been stalking his wife because she was seeing somebody else instead of going to school. So he had started trying to not tap the phones, but try to find out everything that was going on. He was following her, and I said, that's not cool. That ain't spiritual. Don't be stalking, right? He couldn't help it. So he calls me up. I said, where are you at? He said, I'm outside of his apartment. See, y'all are spiritually fit. You don't even know him. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm standing outside the truck. I said, what are you packing? He said, the judge with the 410 shells. I said, oh, you're going for gusto. The shotgun shells and the pistol. He said, yeah. I said, who are you going to take out, Al? He said, both. I said, would you do me a favor? You know, sometimes you just sit there and pray as fast as you can pray. God, don't let me screw this up. I don't have the power to heal anybody, but I have the power given to me to help another human being. You don't know how that stands sometimes. You wing it with God. Oh, give me the right thing to say, because I know exactly what's going to happen. He's going to go in, kick the door in, and the gun's blazing. And it will ruin the rest of his life. But he doesn't care. There was a reason that he called me. I said, what? I said, what? And then it hit home. I said, would you do me a favor? He said, yeah. I said, I'm your sponsor. He said, yeah. You're my sponsee. He said, yeah. I said, we're brothers. We're best friends. He said, yeah. I said, just do one favor. Just one. Don't shoot him? I said, no. Would you please just get your butt in the truck? That's step one when you're new. Get in the truck. We're going to the meeting. And God said, take him back to the basics. Bring him home. So I said, would you please just get in the truck and sit down so we can talk about this? And he said, all right, sponsor, I'll do that for you. And I said, good. Can I ask you another favor? What's that? I said, would you put your hand on the key? And one by one, I guided him away, or gave him the opportunity to just drive away from the situation that he was in, because we knew it was going to be bad. He texted me again today, 16 years later. When you're working these steps and you begin to get spiritually fit, you are able to do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to be able to do over and over and over again. You're able to hear that small, still voice when you need to hear it. And you're able to hear the other voices when you're not wanting to hear them also. I thought, well, once you get this conscious contact of God and you start working these things, how we're supposed to establish our relationship with God, we work the steps, we go through the amends process, we do, of course, the inventory, we admit them to another human being, which is the big killer, right? And you blow right by 6 and 7, right? It's only one paragraph in the big book, so you just blow right by them. Wait till later, I'll tell you. Boom! Just a paragraph apiece. And I start going off with this list of people that I've harmed, and I go making amends. I'm doing this stuff every day now, and I'm just like spiritually fit, I think. That ought to last all the time. But then you start going through some hard things in life. Things are not lining up at work the way they're supposed to be lining up. You're not making the money you think you ought to be making. You're not driving what you think you ought to be making. They're not acting the way. You end up getting divorced. You know, I got divorced before I got to AA. I got divorced at year 10 in the AA, and I said, that's it. I'm done. I am never going to have another relationship. So 2.5 years later, I got married again, right? You know the deal, right? Boy meets girl on the AA campus, 12 and 12 approved. And my sponsor says, she's 18 years younger than you are. I said, that, there's nothing that mentions that in the big book. He says, she has 6 months and you have 10 years. And I said, that ain't in the big book. He said, well, here's what's going to happen. If you date this woman, you're going to get a reputation you do not want to get. So here's what I suggest. If you want to do this, I firmly suggest that you date with other AA and Al-Anon couples and not alone. And I'm like, I'm a grown man. What do you mean? Now you're going to start pulling all the strings on me. You know, you get a little arrogant after a while. I know exactly what I'm doing. So at year 25, when I got divorced again, I'm trying to speedball through this thing, right? I thought it was a Camelot wedding. We dated for 2.5 years with other couples. Then we ended up getting married on the third year. Lasted 13 years. I had a massive heart attack in 2012 when I was 24 years sober. I had built that construction company up to this great big massive thing because I wanted to be somebody. You could drive past my house in the gated community with all the doctors and the lawyers. And I was like the contractor in the neighborhood. Who is that guy? That's a contractor. He's living with us? Yes. You drive by there and that hit that garage door and that Mercedes sports car is right there and I'm looking good. You hit the other garage door and that Corvette's in there and I'm looking good. What they don't see, though, is 23 hours a day I'm going, trying to keep that facade up with all that stuff. Had a massive heart attack. So I'm laying on the cath lab. And the doctor says, you got a perfect exercise routine. Your wife is a director of nursing. You got a perfect diet routine. Your wife is a director of nursing. He said, but dude, you are so stressed out. You have turned your blood to cottage cheese. I had no idea stress would do that to a body. He said, you need to have a total change in lifestyle. I said, I'll tell you what, when I get off of this slab, because you know when you get these stents put in your heart, you're awake. You're watching it on TV. Woo! And they are pushing stuff up from places they shouldn't be pushing. And you can watch that stainless steel stent go all the way. They put three of them right into my heart. And I said, I'll tell you what, when I get done with this, I'm going to go find those SOBs that caused all that stress. He said, whoa, let me get you a mirror. That sounds like my sponsor. You're the one that caused that stress. And I'm like, oh, man. He said, I need you to have you got to have a total change in lifestyle. I'll be your cardiologist. You need a total change in lifestyle. I said, okay. I went home, started selling all that stuff. Then I got divorced. She did not like that change of lifestyle. So I ended up I'm 25 years sober. I'm divorced a third time. What the heck is wrong with me? Bill Wilson put this magical phrase. The big book is my basic text. It's my go-to stuff. 13 years later, they printed a 12 and 12. And I believe in exactly what he put on that page, right? We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And I think 13 years later, Bill Wilson said, good God, these people are crazy. I need to describe every single step in depth and give them some kind of traditions because they're killing each other. and the husbands and the wives. So 13 years later, Bill Wilson put this statement in there. And it was published a couple of years before I was born. But it is from the twisted relations with family, friends, and society at large that many of us have suffered the most. He doesn't cut to the chase, does he? We have been especially stupid and stubborn about them. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. And I thought, good God. And the sponsor shook his head. You have never been able to form a true partnership. What that looked like was, if you liked me, I would hurt you. If you loved me, I would hurt you again and again until you left. Hence the three divorces. I said, what do I do about that? He said, now maybe you're ready to take certain steps. Remember steps 6 and 7? I said, yeah. He said, after you did your 4-step inventory and you found out about all that stuff, and then you admitted to God, yourself, and another human being, you were supposed to go to God and say, help me relieve all these defects of character, and help me want to get willing to relieve the defects of character, and then I'm going to pray that you remove my shortcomings. I said, well, it was only a paragraph. He said, well, read it in the 12 and 12. It's an entire chapter. And I said, what do I do? When I left that divorce hearing from the judge, and we signed the paperwork, walked out of the courthouse, she went to the right, and I went to the left. I got in my sponsor's truck with all my homies from the Big Book group, and off we went to Panama City to see Clancy, my grand sponsor, great grand sponsor. And they put me in a motel room at 25 years sober, and they gave me 2 legal pads. One of them said step 6, defects of character. The other one said step 7, shortcomings. I said, I've read that treatise that Bill wrote. People asked him, why did you use 2 different words? Why did you use defect of character and shortcomings? Oh, I didn't want to use the same word twice. They said, but for you, something has to be different. Step 6, defect of character. I want you to write this. Everything that I did that I never should have done. Wow. He said, give each one a number. And on here, step 7, your shortcomings, everything that I should have been doing instead of what I was doing over here. He said, you know, when you were at the Hawaii State Convention, enjoying all the Waikiki Beach festivities for 10 days, where was your family? I said, oh, they were back at home. So the wife was back at home, kids were back at home. Yeah. When you traveled all around the nation, going to all these different conferences, where was the family? Oh, they were home. Kids were home, wife was home. You see, when I drank, I made alcoholic widows and alcoholic orphans. I was never there. I would work and I would start drinking and I would disappear. Come home enough to sleep, shave, sometimes shower, change uniforms, go back to work again. Do it again, repeat, do it again, repeat, do it again, repeat. Now I'm sober. What am I doing? Now I'm making AA widows and AA orphans. I disappeared everywhere. I left them behind. He said, okay, what should you do? What should you have done instead? I said, either I should have took them with me or not gone. He said, good, go to the next item. And item by item, remember how he used to have me read the book and then if I had questions, item by item, now I've got a big book in one hand and a 12 and 12 in the other hand. And that's how I recovered from that. And I began to change. At 25 years sober, I did it for 25 years sober, 26 years sober, I'm working through all this, and now I am single, sober, and serene. Woo! She didn't want nothing. I gave her $20,000 in a Mercedes sports car and she was gone. In the dark. I said, I am single, sober, and serene, and I am never, ever going to get in another relationship. Angie and I had known each other for friends for 14 years. This is the part where I want to tell you, sometimes if you will just listen to that quiet voice when somebody asks you if you want to go somewhere, would you like to go to Mont Eagle? Oh, no, that's way up the mountain, way far away. You know, there's not thousands of people that I can have fun with. Angie and I ended up in a place at Albany, Georgia, that we weren't supposed to be at, with people that we weren't supposed to be with doing stuff we weren't supposed to be doing. My sponsor had reeled me back in to come back to that house, because I had left it after the divorce, come back to the house. While I was doing all that repair work, they were saying, well, where's Chip at? And I'm doing step 6 and 7. And my sponsees were going, I seen him on Facebook. There's nothing sacred about Facebook. It said he's in Hawaii, flying around in a helicopter, looking at waterfalls, getting spiritual with her. Where's he this time? Well, he's over in Virginia. He's over here. He's doing that. He's traveling over here. He's doing this. Reel him back in. So he reeled me back in. So I'm supposed to be painting my house. I got my painters in my house, and my daughter is directing the paint scheme because I'm a Key West kid, so she wanted to do the Caribbean color scheme. She's putting 10-foot queen palms in my living room on the little caster wheels with grow lights way up in the 12-foot ceilings, and I'm like, oh, my God. So we're going to be real Caribbean. She's burning sage. Thank God it was sage all around the house. She's warding off all the ex-wife spirits. I said, I cannot leave these people alone. She's painting my bathroom Tabasco orange. It's bright. He said, I need you to take me to Flint River. I said, I can't take you to Flint River. He said, I need you to tell. I took him every year to Flint River. He was my guy. I said, I can't. I said, let Steve take you. He's the new guy. He said, okay. And then the phone rang, and it was Amanda. I'd known Amanda for 14 years. Angie and Amanda were speaking at a conference one time, and that young wife and I were sitting there, and it was a Tripoli Country Roundup. And we were sitting in the audience, and Angie and Amanda were doing their talk. And my wife sat there, and she said, I love Amanda. I said, cool. So she ran up afterwards and asked Amanda to sponsor. She came back and said, I asked Amanda to sponsor me. And I'm like, cool. Did you tell your sponsor? I'll do that when I get home. So Amanda sponsored my ex-wife. It's a tangled web that we weave here. You think the big book is confusing? I got some stuff that'll scare you, right? So these years later, now I'm sitting there, and Amanda calls me up, and she says, I need you at Flint River. I said, I can't go to Flint. I've been through this with the old-timer. I can't go. She said, I'm telling you, I need you at Flint River. Any of y'all here know Amanda? When Amanda speaks, it's like E.F. Hutton. You know when she walks in the room, she lightens the room up, right? I mean, bright lighting. She said, I'm telling you, I need you at Flint River. And I'm like, I got more time than you. Don't you be ordering me. And then she pulled the trump card out. She said, this is an AA request. I said, that is a foul. You cannot turn down an AA request. She said, and guess what? My mama's going to be there too. And I'm like, ooh. Now, I'd swore off relationships, but that don't mean I can't wink, right? I said, okay. She said, I need you to read for me. She said, Bo's speaking, and my mama's going to get there, and she's going to host and chair Bo's meeting, and I'm going to chair Shirley's meeting, Bo and Shirley Templin, big meeting in the sky. And I need you to bring a suit. And I said, okay. So I got my Johnny Cash dark suit. Went there, and there's a picture that we have on our refrigerator. Now, we were friends for 14 years, and then Amanda kept putting us together closer, closer. But put your arm around her. And 180 days later, we were married. So it just happens that way. When you're spiritually fit, things start getting aligned, and that was almost 10 years ago. There's a lot of crazy stuff that happens. There's a lot of stuff in the big book where it talks about, and in 12 and 12, it starts warning you of things. For if the alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice to others, he cannot surmount the certain trials and low spots that lie ahead. And there are trials and low spots that lie ahead. Sometimes we figure out working these steps and helping other people is like putting on your spiritual armor. When you're ready. I'm going to give you two more examples. Have I got time? Another hour. I'm drinking this water. Y'all didn't even come check to make sure it was water. Could be Dr. Pepper. Trust me. You heard my story. There's going to be three people checking, right? What was I going to talk about? Okay. Remember I was talking to you about Al and being spiritually fit and being able to hear the things that you're supposed to hear. I had changed sponsors. Angie and I got married. We moved to the beach, right? Changed sponsors, changed home groups. That guy still is he's my road dog. I still drive him to conventions. Sometimes when you change sponsors, it's like a freaking divorce. When people don't understand, they're just like, he fired him? You weren't in the room. So I changed sponsors, and I went to Jerry Wills in Jacksonville. I'd known Jerry for years. Angie and I were just married, and he had a relationship that I loved with Jill. So I asked him to sponsor me. Throughout the years, Jerry started getting sicker and sicker. He had a terminal lung disease, and he started warning all his 15 guys. We were on Zoom all the time with him at his house, and he said, y'all need to go ahead and prepare. And we know what that meant. We're going to go find another sponsor and get them lined up. I was at the old timers convention with sponsor number one, my road dog, and the phone rang, and I looked, and it was Angie. She normally never calls me during a weekend. So I said, hello? And she said, I just didn't want you to see it on Facebook. It's all over Facebook. I said, Jerry died? She said, yeah. I said, thank you. I love you. I said, hello? Ring. Hello, Tim? And Tim answered the phone in Kentucky, and he was ready because we had done the prep work. He said, I'll be glad to carry you on this journey. Keep carrying you on the journey that Jerry had. I said, thank you. He said, but I think there's a reason that you called me. I said, yeah, I don't go without a sponsor. He said, no, I think there's a reason that you called me. I said, what? He said, right now, I think I need you a whole lot more than you need me. And I did not realize that his wife, Gail, had gone back into cancer again, second time, and she only had a couple weeks left to live. And see, he thought I was his little angel, calling him on the phone, putting on that spiritual gear, getting him ready. A little while later, my father passed away, and Angie told me, she said, you go, and you stay. He was 5.5 hours away, 93 years old, commander was ready to go. But she said, you go and you just stay until it's over, instead of trying to commute. So I went and I stayed, and thank God I had made amends to him 33 years before that, and our relationship was restored. Actually, it was renewed. And I was able to be there with my dad during that whole period of time. And it taught me a valuable lesson. Because I got a phone call from a guy of mine that I sponsored, and he said, I need you. And I said, I'm thinking Saturday. Okay, you go. And I went and I picked him up. Now JW, I'm a 100% disabled veteran. JW is a PTSD helicopter mechanic, pulling dead, burning bodies out of helicopter type of PTSD. Whole lot different than the stuff I have going on. He has a lot of bad times. But he's sober, and he's going through the steps. And so I said, okay, so I'll go to pick him up, because he ain't got a driver's license. To this day, he rides his electric skateboard to the meeting. So cool. Hair flying in the breeze with his bandana. Woo! But at that time, he was in bad shape. And he called me up. Everything was starting to hit him. We sat on that picnic table for 4 hours, and he just dumped. Sometimes I have found, in my time in sobriety, the best thing I can be to somebody is just an ear. Just listen, because people have stuff they got to get out. So I sat there for 4 hours, and I didn't interrupt him, and he dumped, and he dumped, and he dumped. And afterwards, he said, whew, Sponce. I said, how you doing? He said, man, I'm a lot better. You rode me through the storm. I said, you rode me through the storm. Now, we have this saying that we have with the little sponsorship fellowship tree that we have. And we always tell the guy, hey, thank you for my spiritual exercise, because it helped me build my spiritual muscle. With my spiritual muscle, I can get through anything, but I got to have spiritual exercise. So anytime we try to do something with somebody else, oh, thank you for my spiritual exercise. So when I got done, I took him home and I drove down the road. This is the day after Father's Day. And I pulled off the side of the road. I said, man, I forgot to do it. So I pulled off the side of the road. I said, thank you for my spiritual exercise, all 4 hours worth, because I got some spiritual muscle. 40 seconds later, I got the text, my son just died. And he thought I was there for him. But he was there for me, building my spiritual muscle by spiritual exercise, simply because I answered the call. And I was at a place I wasn't supposed to be with, doing stuff I wasn't supposed to be doing with people I wasn't supposed to be with, and just simply answering the call. The highest rank you get is sober. There's no academy you go to for speaker. There's no PowerPoint presentations, no Toastmasters. There's no speed course you can get through all this stuff. There's just a fellowship of people that help you during the hardest times of your life. We all went through this thing called Zoom. Still got 5 minutes? We went through this thing called Zoom. A lot of people fought this thing called Zoom. They ended up having me do this workshop on this. You know, we were doing all the Zoom conferences worldwide. They asked me to do this workshop on the electronic transmission of Alcoholics Anonymous, the history of it. And I went back and it said that we're supposed to present an adequate presentation. So I went and did all my homework, did all my studying, built this thing together. And here's what happened with me. In 2019, we knew that I was falling apart. I started having surgery. So in 2018, we knew I was going to have surgeries. In 2019, we started touring. We took 3 weeks and we toured all the entire country of Europe in a bullet train. Wow! 300 kilometers an hour, all through the entire country, 13 different cities. We had a blast. Then we went to Alaska for 2 weeks. We had a blast because we knew I was going to have to lay out once they started tearing my shoulders apart. So I went to the first surgery and I thought, oh, cool. But when they did the surgery, they said, there's something going on with your neck. Remember that heart attack I had in 2012? Now they're going, there's a blockage. I survived the Widowmaker, now I got the Stroke Maker. 80% blocked. That's what feeds the brain, the blood to the brain. I said, oh my God, we're going to have to go in there. They sliced my throat, right? Still had the bandages on from the other surgery. Anesthesia. Dilaudid. Oxycodone. 30-some years sober with nothing. Ventilator tubes. Then I went down for the second surgery. Anesthesia, oxycodone, ventilator tubes. Then they said, your other shoulder has to be redone. I still had bandages on my neck. They did the third surgery. Anesthesia, oxycodone, ventilator tubes. I said, well, hell, then they did the fourth surgery. I thought, I'm done. 8 weeks later, I still had the bandage on my neck, massive heart attack, quadruple bypass. Never YouTube your surgery before you have it. I got a good home group. This COVID thing's coming across the water. Everybody's going crazy, and I have a friggin' heart attack, right? So I call my sober surgeon. Always have a sober surgeon. I call my sober surgeon. I said, blah, 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 blah. He said, you're in the middle of a heart attack. I need you in the emergency room. Don't come to my office. You come right now. I said, I would, but Mickey is getting his 10-year medallion this morning. Only alcoholics, right? But only an alcoholic surgeon understands an alcoholic sponsor. All right, have Angie in the parking lot with the car running. Bring her to the emergency room. Went to the emergency room. The gurneys are lined up. COVID is rampant. We're in there. They're wheeling through. People are coughing. There ain't a mask in there. Doctors coming by with laptops. I don't know what the hell is going on. They rushed me up to the cardiac unit. That was the 3rd of March. On the 9th of March, they do the surgery. I had to wait 6 days, pump me full of nitroglycerin to open everything up, and that makes you wide awake. And they did surgery. When I woke up out of the surgery, they had this laptop. And they did something with the laptop, and there's my home group on the screen. I'm loaded on Dilaudid. And I'm like, what the? Who knew what Zoom was before COVID pandemic? I said, what is that? They said, that's your home group. They're all waving, you know, Brady Bunch. I said, hey, y'all. They said, oh, no, you're muted. I'm loaded. I'm like, I got stuff to say. No. I'm an old timer. I can say no. Just wouldn't let me do the unmute. And I learned how to Zoom. I was medically quarantined for 1 year, couldn't leave the house unless Angie took me out for a ride. Because of all those surgeries and all that anesthesia, I was so susceptible, right? Like a lot of people were. They had the home health people come stand at my doorway. Angie wouldn't even let them in the house. Nope, physical therapy right there. And then the nurses came. And there, she said, nope, stand at the doorway. You better be masked up, gowned up, shielded up, bootied up. All. She protected me through the whole ordeal. So, Zoom saved my life. I was 30-some years sober, and I was looking at 1 year of lockdown. And I didn't know what Zoom was, but thank God that there was Zoom. I got to be with my sponsor. I got to be with all these people. and it weaned me. It let me go through all this stuff and recover. But what happened was it screwed my mind up. Something happened. And that's what we're dealing with now. I started losing my memory. I started losing my personality. Angie said, I never knew you when you drank, but according to your story, it sounds like you are reverting back to the person that you used to be, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And so one night I broke down and I called my sober surgeon. I said, I am having night tremors. I'm night sweating. I'm wetting the bed from sweat. I said, So he sent me to a psychiatrist who ended up sending me to a trauma therapist who ended up sending me to a neuropsychologist, and they diagnosed me with cognitive memory decline. And they don't know what the heck caused it, but something caused it. And Angie, in her profession, she said, what's the prognosis? He said, vascular dementia, because he has arterial plaque disease. Remember all that blockage. The doctor said, the good thing is the last thing to go is going to be his recovery. And his business, right? If the alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice with others, he cannot surmount the certain trials and low spots that lie ahead. So all we had to do is reestablish a game plan. What are we going to do now? Have no idea. What are we going to do now? So we just came up with a plan. We just shifted. That's all we did. I watch people when they have traumatic things happen to them and they just bail. But this, you know, if my life's going to be that short, I'm just going to blow it out the rest of the time. Not me, I'm going to be in Mont Eagle. next week it'll be Chipley. So, because y'all are my people, my mother doesn't believe it. There's nothing wrong with your memory. And Angie said, unless you live with him, you won't watch it slide. And it's been sliding away for the past couple of years. So I do all this spiritual exercise with my memory. And I probably bother the hell with Angie. Bother Angie like hell because I have to try to remember stuff all the time. And I'll keep asking her. This is a muscle. And spiritual exercise begets spiritual muscle. So that's what we do. We can't control the wind, so we just shift the sail. Thank you. I can't wait to be with you all weekend long. I love you guys.